My second book, A Heart as Wide as the World, was about to come out. There was this whole period of time in which we couldn't find a title for it. And I don't know how many of you have ever been in this position where you've tried to find a title or a name for something, but I was absolutely obsessed. I was leading a retreat actually down in California, and one of my co-teachers came in and said, "I don't want to sit next to you anymore." Because when I sit next to you, all he can think of is book titles. And the publisher had some other title, which I didn't really like. And I came upon the phrase, "A Heart as Wide as the World," and I really wanted it to be called that. So I called them up, and they weren't too happy because they had to have a book cover like within 24 hours to go into the catalog. And they weren't so happy about my changing the name at that point, but they said, okay. And then they scrambled to try to get an image that could convey A Heart as Wide as the World. And they faxed me this painting by Van Gogh, which I don't remember the name of it, but it was this huge, huge kind of menacing yellow sky with these little crumbled buildings down in the bottom. And I guess they chose it because of that sense of wide, you know. And I looked at it, and I called them up, and I said, "That looks like it should be the cover of The Grapes of Wrath," or something like that, you know. And I showed it to a friend of mine who was sitting there, and I said, "What do you think?" And she just looked at it, and she said, "That looks like a world that needs some love." And recently that phrase, "That looks like a world that needs some love," has been coming back and back in my mind as I look at our world. I think this is a world that really needs some love. But so much confusion happens when we all have different associations with that word. What does love mean? You know, does it mean friendship in that sense that the Buddha used the word metta? Does it mean attachment? Does it mean conditionality? Now, I will love you as long as you love me in return, or as long as the following 15 conditions are met. Or I once used this example, and someone in the group said, "Only 15? You know? Or I will love you as long as you get better. Or can it mean something other than that? Sometimes when we use the word love, it really is used in the sense of a kind of ally of delusion, that sense of everything's fine, you know, everything's just perfect. Let's not look at any problems. Let's not face any difficulties. Let's just pretend. And that veneer of kind of sentimentality, which is really fear, is not, of course, what's meant by love in the sense of metta either. When I emphasize so strongly that I don't see it so much as a feeling or a sentiment, it's because I really see it, I see metta, I see love or loving kindness in that sense, largely as a quality of attention or awareness. It's a facet of awareness. It's how we pay attention in many, many different ways. Once I was leading a retreat in Barrie, and I was asleep at night and dreaming that I was leading a retreat in Barrie, which wasn't the exciting part. But in the dream, I was talking to somebody about meditation practice and just life and all of that. And the person in the dream said to me, "Why do we love people?" And I responded by saying, "Because they recognize us." And then I woke up, and I thought, that was pretty good. You know, we all have some yearning, I think, to be recognized, to have somebody see us, to acknowledge us in a certain way. And when we recognize somebody else, when we see something deeper than just the persona, the social persona we usually offer to one another, or the story, or the habits of mind, there's something extraordinary in that quality of connection. So I see metta as a way of paying attention. For one thing, it's a fullness or a wholeheartedness of attention. I have a friend who, many years ago when we were living in India, went to visit this very great, esteemed, eminent Tibetan Lama known as the 16th Karmapa. And my friend went off to Sikkim, which is where the Karmapa was living, to see him, and said that the Karmapa greeted his presence, his arrival, as though it were just about the most important thing that had ever happened to the Karmapa in his life, which, believe me, it was not. But my friend went on to say that he did that, he conveyed that impression, not through great pomp and circumstance or grandiose flourishes. He conveyed that impression by paying absolute, complete attention to my friend. So my friend said that the subjective experience of that was one of being completely loved. When he told me that story, my first thought was almost a kind of sadness about all of the conversations that I have where I'm kind of there and I'm kind of not, because I'm thinking about the next person I need to talk to or the phone call I need to make or the next thing I need to do. And I realize, you know, it wouldn't take that much to actually be there, to gather my attention and to arrive, to be present. And just that wholeness of attention, that fullness of attention, is like a gift of love. Recently, in trying to explain meditation to people, I've been saying things like, you know, it's learning how to listen to ourselves. Because we certainly live in a world where we're not exactly listening to one another very gracefully. But learning how to pay attention, learning how to listen, learning how to simply connect is something we do within ourselves, and then we bring it out into the world. So that's one way in which metta is really a facet of awareness. It's a wholeheartedness of attention. It also is a facet of awareness or attention because it can shift, it can transform what we pay attention to. Somebody referred earlier today to looking at the good in ourselves. There are two kind of preliminary reflections that are often done in the development of metta. Not because they're the only way that metta can come about, but because they tend to provide easy springboards for metta to come about. In the Buddhist psychology, this is known as the proximate cause. That which is the most ready condition or springboard for something else to happen. So traditionally, the proximate cause for metta is seeing the good in someone, whether that's ourselves or somebody else. And that's an exercise. If we're looking at somebody else and we don't like them, then our minds naturally will want to go over and over and over the thing they said or the thing they did and how much we don't like them. And if we do that, then naturally we will want to recoil. We will want to separate. We will want to pull away. Whereas if we can find one little sliver of good, even in a great wealth of difficulty, it changes things. It doesn't change things in the way we might be afraid of, which is that we'll pretend everything's just fine and we won't stand up for ourselves or maybe take very strong action to seek change. It doesn't do that at all. But it's as though if we can bring ourselves to acknowledge that one good thing, there's a sense of connection. There's some bridge that is built. And from that vantage point, we can directly and honestly look at all of the difficulty, but it's without quite that same sense of that huge gulf of self and other, or us and them, as though what somebody else was doing couldn't possibly bear any relationship to anything we've ever wanted or been afraid of or been lost in. And that's just not so. We look at the good in others because it's a balance, and that includes ourselves. think about, you know, sometime you said something really stupid, or you made some terrible mistake. When that happens, our whole field of attention tends to collapse. We become just that one stupid remark. The 50,000 nice things we did that day, they're gone. That whole sense that everything changes all of the time. Everybody has the potential to change all of the time. The recognition we can always begin again, it's gone. Because we are fixated, we're collapsed, we're stuck in that mistake. We look at the good just to bring some balance. It's not to pretend that that mistake never happened, that we didn't cause harm or nobody had ever harmed us. It's not about make-believe, but it brings some balance because it is so easy to fixate on the negative, maybe especially with ourselves. It's a very classic Buddhist contemplation. Look for the good in yourself. You know, it's not egotistical or boastful or conceited. It's a balance. Because with that joy, we can have some confidence. We can have some faith in our own potential. It's very important. We look for the good in others, too. Just to see what happens. I really mean it when I say it's like an adventure. You know, I think we're so oriented toward thinking of adventure as external, you know, climbing a mountain or doing something dramatic outside. It's an amazing inner adventure. Just to see what happens when I turn my mind this way, what happens when I turn my mind that way. It's not forcing, but it's uncovering. It's so interesting. So as I said, I first did this practice intensively, systematically in Burma in 1985. And Saito Upandita, my teacher, recommended at one point, I think I was about to do metta for a difficult person, which is one of the categories, and he said, see if you can see some good in that person. Now, just as a side note, when we do metta for a difficult person, it's not meant that we're supposed to start with the person who has hurt us the most in this life or has behaved so horribly in the course of history. It's just about unimaginable. We're supposed to start with somebody that we feel a little bit of conflict for or impatience or fear, since metta is the direct antidote to fear. Because the practice is meant to be done in the easiest way possible. So that was part of the instruction as well, which I'll go into much more tomorrow. But anyway, so he said, now go back to your room and think of somebody, and before you offer them metta, see if you can see the good in them. And my very first thought was, I'm not going to do that. I thought, that's what stupid people do. You know, they go around looking for the good in everybody. I thought, I don't even like people who are like that. You know, I'm not going to do that. But as I tell the story, I was very far from home. I was in a Burmese monastery. And the nature of the teacher-student relationship in a very traditional culture like that is not one where the teacher suggests you do something and you say, I don't feel like it. Or that's not a good idea. You actually do it. And so I did it, and I found, much to my amazement, it worked. And it worked just in the way it was supposed to work. Not that I became this sort of idiotic, you know, Pollyanna, everything's just fine, you know, deluded person, but that I felt some kind of connection rather than so completely isolated. And from that vantage point of connection, I felt I could look at the difficulties without such a huge gulf. In terms of the Buddhist cosmology, which of course not everyone believes in, we have all died and been reborn countless times, over and over and over again. So that those of us sitting here in this room right now have all done everything. We're trailing an infinite number of previous lives, in the course of which we've all done everything and been everything for one another. We've hurt one another and saved one another and helped one another. We've been one another's friends and enemies, parents, children. We've shed many tears together. We've all done everything. So I often think from the perspective of that cosmology, the single most illogical emotion is that of self-righteousness. To think, oh, I, who am so perfect and immaculate, way over here, am looking at you, way over there, who've done that horrible thing, which I could never, ever, ever, ever do, because guess what? We've done it. You know, and again, that doesn't mean we don't try to change the world or stop somebody from doing it again or take care of ourselves. We do. But it doesn't have to come from that place of feeling so separate. And we've all seen the consequences of a very rigid sense of self and other. We've seen it again and again and again. And if you don't feel at all in harmony with that cosmology, and certainly you don't need to, I don't think it takes a whole lot of introspection for somebody to realize how much fear and how much desire, how much greed, how much jealousy, how much anger comes up in one's mind. You know, sometimes I joke and I say, well, there are lots of different ones, but, one is, you know, what if we had like a person designated each sitting to act out every impulse that came up in their minds? You know, and the rest of us could just watch. It would be interesting, wouldn't it? It would be wild. It doesn't take a lot to realize that these things come up. We may never act on them because of our own awareness, our wisdom, our background, our conditioning, our sheer good luck. But to imagine we don't feel them, I don't think so. You know, so from one kind of understanding or another, we can have that sense of almost the commonality of beings and make the effort to look at the good, not denying the bad or the difficult. So that's one way we use our attention. The other reflection, because sometimes that's just unreal, there's no way in the world, whether we're looking at ourselves or somebody else, we are going to be able to see the good, even if it's one little thing. And the other reflection we do then is right out of the Buddha's teaching, which is a very simple teaching, that all beings everywhere want to be happy. Everybody wants to be happy. It's because of ignorance, the force of ignorance, that we don't know where happiness is actually to be found, that we do the very things that cause so much suffering for ourselves and for others. But everybody, on some level, wants the same thing. We want that sense of belonging, of having a home in this life, of having a connection to something greater than our limited, normally limited sense of who we are. We all want to be happy. And that's an important thing to remember. Our own desire for happiness is nothing to be squeamish about or ashamed of or feel that it's wrong. That urge, in some ways, is the most beautiful thing about us. It's not greed. It's right. It's rightful. It's appropriate to want to be happy. What's very important is the wisdom. Where is happiness actually going to be found? Is it as we normally walk through life? You know, getting and having and wanting. I wear this mala, you know, this set of beads in my wrist. I was in at Spirit Rock sometime when my book Faith came out, and I was on tour, and I was I needed a copy of the book before I gave the talk, and I didn't have one. So they had set up a bookstore. They just had a retreat, which apparently involved a lot of shopping in it. And so instead of just the normal bookstore, which they have down the hill, some of you I know have been there, they moved everything up to their walking room. And not only did they have books, but they had like paintings and tankas and objects and jewelry and all kinds of things. And so I walked upstairs to get my book, and this dangling down was the first thing that I saw. And my first thought was, I need that. But actually, at the time, I was wearing two others. And I thought, not only don't I need it, I don't even have room for it. But it was my very first thought, I need that. And actually, I used that example in the talk, and somebody who worked there came up and gave it to me. So that was nice. But, you know, that's so often how we move through life. I need that. I need that. I don't have enough. I need more. I want something else. I mean, is that really the source of much happiness? And it's a very powerful question. Where is happiness actually to be found? But our urge toward happiness is quite rightful. Because when combined with wisdom instead of with ignorance, it can cut through a lot of obstacles. It becomes like a homing instinct for freedom. And just as we want to be happy, and that's right, we realize that in some way everybody deserves to be happy. That's true. We all want to be happy. We're not so very different. And so sometimes we need to reflect on that to see what options open up for us. This is the sense of adventure, is because we can be so habituated, we can be so in a rut. You know, it's not that doing metta or trying to see things in a different way is phony or it's an imposition. It really is saying, what happens when I step out of the rut? Maybe I want to step back in, who knows? But at least we wonder. And we experiment, we explore. Then we have options. Then we can be free to make a choice instead of just being bound by our conditioning. So we pay attention to the good in someone, whether it's ourselves or someone else. We reflect on that universal wish to be happy. That's another way that metta is really about how we're paying attention. And then it's almost like the sheer force of attention is the practice of metta. There are so many beings in this world we look right through. We don't connect to as living, breathing beings who want to be happy just like we do. We look right around them. We ignore them. The practice of metta, rather than the creation of an emotion, is like a greater inclusiveness of attention, so that we include more and more and more beings in that attention, which is connection, which is care. And we open and we open and we open in that way. As we do the practice classically, as I've alluded to, we go through these different categories of beings, starting with ourselves, then a benefactor, then a friend, then someone known as a neutral person, which I'll come back to in a minute, and then someone who is mildly difficult, and then different groups of beings, and then all beings everywhere, without distinction, without exclusion. Now, the neutral person is somebody I find quite interesting. It's actually my favorite part of the practice. A neutral person is someone we don't strongly like or dislike. It's someone we feel kind of neutral about. And even coming to consider that is often an interesting place. Sometimes we find that we don't have very many neutral people in our lives. You know, as soon as we meet somebody or even hear they exist, we have a judgment about them. We like them or we don't like them. But very, very commonly, we find that we have a great number of neutral people in our lives, that we do look right through people. We don't give them the time or the space or the gift of attention. What's amazing to me about this part of the practice, and the reason I like it so much, is that simply by connecting to somebody, paying attention to them instead of ignoring them, we grow to care. Not because they've done an enormous great deed for us and we feel almost obligated to wish them well. Not because they've challenged us or hurt us and we feel, okay, there's my edge. You know, I'll never be free until I get beyond this. It's just because we're finally not ignoring them. that amazing things ensue. My very favorite story about that is from this time. I teach a loving kindness retreat and then a Vipassana retreat every year in Barrie, usually in February. Next year it's in March, but it's almost always in February. And I had a friend sit that loving kindness retreat one February, in which we went through the whole classical sequence of all these different categories. I didn't see her again for many months until I was teaching another retreat in New Mexico. She came up to me in New Mexico and she was all kind of beaming and shiny, and she said to me, "I've fallen in love with my dry cleaner." And I said, "Really? I'm so happy for you." And she said, "No, not romantically." She said, "He was my neutral person back in the course I did in February. And every day when I meditate, I hold him in my heart and I wish him well." And she said, "Now when I go into the store, I really want to see how he's doing. You know, it really means something to me." You know, I don't even know if she ever learned his name. And she didn't, I know, learn the circumstances or the story of his life, his particular sorrows or troubles. It was just because she was actually every day holding him in her heart and paying attention to him. So this was, I don't know, like 8 years ago, something like that at this point. And a few years ago, I was writing an article on loving kindness meditation for a magazine. And I happened to run into this woman. And so I said, "Is it okay if I use your name and tell your story?" And she said, "Oh, you know, certainly." And then she said, "You know, I still go into the store and I still have that feeling, how is he? How's he doing?" There's something about that that I find extraordinary. And I know it's the common experience. Usually when we do metta for a neutral person in the beginning, it's really boring. And we know nothing about this person. There's no hook to get us going. But over time, this is what happens. We feel aligned, like we're on the same team. When I teach loving kindness in retreat, especially in longer retreats, we often say, we'll try to find a neutral person from amongst the group, because you'll run into this person over and over again. And it's so interesting, because here again, you know, there's a great gap often between what we're feeling at an emotional level when we're sitting and what's really happening. Many times, for weeks and weeks, people will say, "I don't feel anything, you know, this neutral person's really boring, and I'm not doing it right, I must be doing it wrong, because I don't feel anything." And then one day I'll get a note that says, "My neutral person wasn't at breakfast, could you please go check and make sure they're okay?" And I think, you're right, that's what this person wants, is me knocking at their door, you know, I'm sure they're asleep. But that's the feeling. It's like, can you make sure they're okay? They're mine, you know? That is happening on a deeper level than kind of the rush of emotion that we all want in the practice. That's how I know that something is happening, no matter what we're feeling. So metta is really, it's a wholeheartedness of attention, it's an inclusiveness of attention. Sometimes it's a specificity of attention, like looking for the good or remembering that we're not all so different, that everybody wants to be happy. It's a tremendous way to play with our experience so that we're not fixed and we're not bound to a sense of our own limitations, to our fears, to our judgments. We can see what happens and make some very free choices from that. It becomes our home base. Or as one of my friends said, it's become my default program. It's really very interesting. They say that the Buddha taught metta as the antidote to fear, the specific antidote to fear. And energetically, you can feel that it's the opposite. If fear is that which cuts us off and pulls us back, metta is that which helps us go forward and connect. But it's not foolish. You know, it's not that we just open till we're destroyed. It's opening with wisdom. It's being able to act strongly. but with clarity, not the confusion of separation. I mean, fear is not that clarifying a force, really, is it? You know, the nature of fear, almost the definition of fear, is tunnel vision. When was the last time you were really afraid and your mind happily said, well, if it doesn't work out this way, it'll work out some other way? That's not the nature of fear. You know, everything closes down. It shrinks down to that one horrible seeming certainty. Whereas metta has the nature of opening, spaciousness, not knowing, but being able to connect anyway. The Buddha said, I think quite beautifully, develop a mind so filled with love it resembles space, which cannot be painted, it cannot be marred, it cannot be ruined. Develop a mind so filled with love it resembles space. I was once teaching at a museum, the Asia Society in New York City. This very young girl came, maybe like 7 years old, with an adult. And I don't know, it was hard to tell in the dynamic whether the child had brought the adult or the adult had brought the child. But I used that example from the Buddha. Develop a mind so filled with love it resembles space. And the little girl raised her hand and said, I don't understand that. How is love like space? That was interesting. So I said, well, I think it's like space in that it's very unconfined. It's very open in that way. It's not limited. And I think it's like space in that it can't be destroyed, really. And that's the example. You know, if someone was throwing paint around in the air somewhere here, there's nowhere in the space for the paint to land. It's not going to matter if it was a very well-chosen color or really a garish mistake. The space isn't going to be ruined by it. So I said this to the little girl, and she thought for a moment. She said, I think that's right. Well, good, you know. That's a relief. Develop a mind so filled with love it resembles space. That can go anywhere, can touch anything, retains its own nature. It isn't destroyed. It's amazing to me that that's considered the capacity of the human heart and everyone's heart. It's not just the special people who've had really lucky lives, you know, and good feeling and great homes. And everybody, according to the Buddha, has this capacity to connect, to care, to be aware, to love with wisdom. And that this is a capacity that's innate to our being. It's something we're born with as a potential, as a capacity. And it's said that it's never, ever destroyed. No matter what we go through, no matter what we've gone through, as a capacity, it's never destroyed. It may be covered over, it may be obscured, it may be something we're out of touch with, and it may be something we don't trust, but it's never destroyed. And so we practice. Not to get something we don't have, and not to strain for something that's really remote, but to reach underneath those thoughts and feelings and memories to find that place that can connect in this way, that can care in this way, that can pay attention in this way, that can recognize and be recognized in this way. We practice to find it, we practice to trust it, and we practice to unfold it, to bring it forth. That's the nature of the meditation. Okay. Thank you. He told me to speak for an hour, and I thought, walking, and then go on with the sitting. The question is, what's the root cause of our difficulty in loving ourselves? I don't know. I suspect these days it's largely cultural. When the Buddha laid out, they say, when the Buddha laid out the loving kindness meditation, it was done. And this is an important principle to understand. It was done so that the sequence is done in the easiest way possible. And so from his point of view, the easiest thing of all is to love ourselves. And that's where we start. And then we move through these gradations of difficulty until we get to the difficult person. And here was another thing when I was in Burma practicing. It took 3 weeks just doing metta for myself and the benefactor. And I kept feeling like I was cheating, you know, because I knew the difficult person was out there. And I thought, well, this isn't going to count unless I'm like sweating and shaking and confronting, you know, this hard, hard thing. And I said something like that to Upandita, who said to me something like, are you crazy? Something like that. He said, why do you want to do things in the hardest way possible? You know, it's meant to be done in the easiest way possible. Because part of what unfolds is confidence. It's understanding the nature of metta, how that's different than desire or attachment. It's confidence that we can begin again, you know, that we can bring this state into different kinds of relationships. And if it's too hard, you just go back and do it for yourself. That's fine. You know, so all that's part of it. So I would gather from that basic principle that in the Buddha's time, it wasn't that hard. And, you know, my ever so famous encounter with the Dalai Lama, where I was at a conference in India with him. It was a very small conference. And it was a number of psychotherapists and one philosopher and me, cognitive scientist, you know, it was very small. And I had the chance to ask him a question. So I said, Your Holiness, what do you think about self-hatred? And he said, what's that? And he was completely bewildered. He said, is it some kind of nervous disorder? And he said, are people like that, are they very violent? He had no clue. He could not comprehend what I was saying. And of course, I was in this room full of psychotherapists who all jumped up, you know, and they're all like, well, you know, it's child-rearing practices and this and this and this and that, you know. And he was like, what is that? And it was just genuine, you know. He did not understand what I was talking about. And at one point he said, but you have Buddha nature. You know, because from the Buddhist point of view, if we really knew who we were underneath everything, we would find this capacity for infinite awareness, for boundless love and compassion, for wisdom, for understanding our lives. That's what we would find. So he kept saying, but you have Buddha nature. How can you think of yourself like that if you have Buddha nature? You know, so I think the truth is that it is largely just our conditioning. But given that, we can work through it. The question was, what do you do, say, when you're walking around the city and you see something like somebody like a homeless person? It depends, and I'll talk a lot more about this tomorrow in terms of action and the action that we take. But from the point of view of metta, the most important thing is how we see them. You know, an action that we might or might not take will flow from different conditions, like our best assessment, you know, of what might be right or helpful or not or something like that. But it kind of reminds me of a few years ago when I was quite sick. I'd had bronchitis and I just couldn't get better. I'd start to get better and then I'd have a relapse and then I'd start to get better and I'd have another relapse, and it just was endless, months and months of being really very sick. And finally, I was getting better, and I was living in New York City in an apartment someone had given me. And I was walking down the street one day, and I heard a woman's voice behind me saying, I've been really sick all winter. So naturally, I felt a kinship to that, and I turned around, and this woman was giving a whole bunch of money to this street person sitting on the sidewalk, and she said, I've been really sick all winter. I've had pneumonia several times. And every time I started to get better, I would just have a relapse. And now I'm finally actually starting to get better, and I just wanted to share the joy. And I looked at that and I thought, God, I just walked right by that guy. You know, it didn't occur to me for a moment to want to share the joy. And I thought, okay, should I turn back? You know, should I say, you're not going to believe this, but I was really sick too, and I'd like to give you some money too, or, you know. You know, but I think what is essential, and again, I'll talk a lot more about this tomorrow, is not whether or not you give the money, because that decision can be based on many factors. But I was very respectful of her recognition that that person sitting on the sidewalk had something to do with her, that his life and her life are somehow connected. You know, so that's the perspective or the vision of metta, which is another way it has something to do with attention. It's really seeing our connection with one another. Whether we're looking at one person or we're sensing a larger body of beings, of creatures of this earth, it's realizing that's the truth of things. That our attention tends to be very dulled to that. But there's almost no more basic truth than how connected we all are anyway, like it or not. And this is the example that I used that got me so much turmoil here when I was talking about subways, when I was here on my book tour, when I said, I was using this example from a friend, Bob Thurman, who teaches Buddhist studies at Columbia University in New York, and he used this example that's very Bob and very New York, in which he said, imagine you're on a subway, and then I looked up in Kane Hall and I said, are there subways here in Seattle? But anyway, Bob said, imagine you're on a subway and with a whole bunch of people, and these Martians come and they zap the subway car so that you're going to be stuck together forever. He said, what do? You know, if somebody's hungry, you feed them. If somebody's freaking out, you try to calm them down, because you're going to be together forever. And that's the truth of things. Whether we like that person or not, that's how things are. Once I was teaching with a friend of mine named Krishnadas, who does Hindu devotional chanting, and we've known each other a very long time. We've done a lot of programs together. We were teaching together in Los Angeles, and it was an extremely loving, wonderful feeling in the room. And he said at one point, as we were ending, he said, I wish we all just lived together. And then he said, I guess we do. You know, because we do. We share this planet, we share this life. That's the vision, that's the quality of understanding that is loving kindness. Doesn't mean you like everybody, and it certainly doesn't mean you're passive or complacent. But we understand that very deeply.